Today at Reader's Corner, Mark Johnson, author of Tuesday Night Massacre, Four Senate Elections, and the Radicalization of the Republican Party. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. While Ronald Reagan's election to the presidency in 1980 certainly garnered most of the headlines, four Senate races that same year had a profound impact on the future of the Republican Party and the nation itself. In his latest book, Tuesday Night Massacre, Four Senate Elections and the Radicalization of the Republican Party, Mark Johnson reexamines the defeat of four U.S. Senate incumbents, one of whom was Frank Church of Idaho. The turnover of these seats not only allowed Republicans to gain control of the Senate for the first time since 1954, but also set the stage for the divisive partnership that has become a constant feature of American politics. Mark Johnson served as a top aide to Idaho's longest-serving governor, Cecil Andrus. His writings on politics and history have been published in the New York Times and elsewhere, and he manages a blog and podcast called Many Things Considered. He last joined us in 2019 to talk about his previous book, Political Hellraiser, The Life and Times of Senator Burton K. Wheeler of Montana. Mark Johnson, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Bob, it's a delight to be with you again. Thank you.
Well, this is just great to have your book published and out on the streets. And I think what we ought to do is begin with your giving us a setup. We all know, of course, that Reagan was elected in 1980, that he was elected in part because things weren't going well for Jimmy Carter. But in the meantime, there are these four elections. And remind us or refresh us if it's necessary for those who may have known once upon a time. In some of these cases, these may be folks people never have heard of. But tell us about these four races.
Well, you know, the thesis of the book, Bob, is that a number of things came together in 1980 in a way that was difficult, I think, to understand or appreciate at the time. But given the perspective of looking back 40 years, you can see these things really changed American politics. And what I think came together in 1980 was three or four things. Political opinion polling became really sophisticated. You could really target voters and deliver opinion polling information in a way that really was very sophisticated. And this was a relatively new phenomenon in 1980. At the same time, you had the rise of what we now know as independent expenditure committees, these so-called independent groups that were emboldened by a Supreme Court decision in 1976 that allowed them to raise and spend unlimited amounts of money independent of a politician's campaign. You had, for the first time, really, the mobilization of evangelical Christian voters in the 1980 cycle. And you had this group, National Conservative Political Action Committee, started in 1975 by a bunch of really aggressive, ultra-right-wing conservative activists, and they had the ear and the support of some of the new lights, if you will, on the new right, people like Jesse Helms, the very conservative senator from North Carolina. And they targeted four United States senators, Democrats, in 1980, Frank Church in Idaho, Birch Bayh in Indiana, John Culver in Iowa, and George McGovern in South Dakota. And starting very early in that campaign cycle, they began an effort to systematically redefine these guys with attacks on their character, their patriotism. And by the time the election gets really engaged in the summer of 1980, all of these incumbents who had been very popular in their states and reelected quite easily in the past had real trouble. And it was really the beginning of kind of the systematic nationalization of these Senate campaigns that is so obvious today.
Let's talk about this independent expenditure committee. How independent were they really? It seems as though in reading your book, in almost every one of them, there were charges of illegal collaboration, and you might explain what that means. But how do you prove that?
Yeah, well, that's the difficulty. How do you prove it? Where's the smoking gun? I think I provide a lot of circumstantial evidence and some documentary evidence that there really was a level of coordination that was pretty well concealed, hidden at the time. between these independent groups and the Republican candidates that they ostensibly were supporting. Under the federal election laws that were passed in the early 1970s and then modified slightly after the Watergate controversy, there was a real effort to sort of rein in this independent expenditure effort. And the Supreme Court case in 1976 basically upended that effort and allowed, I think, really opened the floodgates for the first time. Subsequent Supreme Court cases have further advanced the cause, but really opened the floodgates to bring all kinds of new money into American politics. The one stipulation was that if you're going to raise that kind of money and spend it independently of a campaign, then you had to have no contact whatsoever with the campaigns that you were supporting. But in fact, NCPAC shared polling information with the candidates that it was trying to recruit into these campaigns. They had operatives on the ground who were well known to the Republican establishments in each of these states. They cultivated a guy like Steve Sims in Idaho by having him, while he was in the House of Representatives before challenging Frank Church, participate in their training sessions and fundraising efforts. So there was a lot of cross-pollination between these groups and the Republican candidates who emerged in 1980 to challenge the Democratic incumbents.
And over the years, they've played a significant role, haven't they, in actually recruiting candidates like you just suggested with Sims?
Well, you know, it's hard to find an example in the late 1970s and into the early 1980s of somebody that I think most political observers, journalists, and scholars who studied this period would identify as a member of the new right, this sort of cutting edge of the conservative movement in that period, who was not in some way affiliated or linked to NCPAC and this kind of web of other similar organizations that grew up simultaneously with NCPAC. So there was lots of cross-pollination between NCPAC and the American Conservative Union and the Eagle Forum, Phyllis Schlafly's outfit, the Moral Majority, the Reverend Jerry Falwell's organization, the Heritage Foundation. They were all part of the same mix of new right groups that were coming together to really change American politics and frankly, to take over the Republican Party, which I argue in the book they have succeeded in doing.
You know, it's amazing when you read your book, you're reading about some key players who seem to have kind of drifted into the historical background and then lately reemerged. And I wonder if we could just take two or three of them and have you tell us who they were and what key roles they played. I'll start with Terry Dolan, because he was the NCPAC strategist. Wasn't he the guy that kind of put it all together?
He really was. Terry Dolan was a young college Republican activist, worked on some campaigns in the Northeast in the early 1970s. And he came together with two other conservative activists in that period, Roger Stone. Yes, that Roger Stone, one who's been in the news so much the last few years. He was one of the founders of NCPAC, along with Dolan, and another guy by the name of Charlie Black, who is still around in Washington, D.C., still quite a prominent lobbyist in D.C. With encouragement from Jesse Helms, they formed this political action committee, NCPAC. And Helms also brought to the table Richard Viguerie, who is also still around, sometimes referred to as the funding father of the new right,
Love that title. Yeah.
A direct mail guru. I quote someone in the book as saying, before there was a Rush Limbaugh, there was a Richard Viguerie. So Terry Dolan, you ask about Terry Dolan. I saw a quote the other day, Bob, from Charlie Sykes, who I'm sure you know of, the conservative Never Trump columnist, former radio talk show host in Wisconsin. He described Rush Limbaugh in words that I think fit almost to a T, Terry Dolan. He said he was a master of using parodies as weapons. He was outrageous and daring, occasionally funny and charming, but also very often dishonest and offensive. That's a pretty good characterization of Dolan. He was, you know, a telegenic, quotable. Press recounts of him are, you know, quite flattering in many ways because he was very candid, very outspoken, you know, great at stirring up controversy.
And I must say, I'd like you to share this with our listeners, but it's a sad commentary on the man. He was definitely a very conflicted guy and would take after things like gay rights, for example. But boy, later in his life, it would show that he was, as you used the word, dishonest. I guess you could say he was dishonest with himself, first and foremost.
Well, he was a deeply closeted gay man who only at the time of his death did it become obvious to even some of his closest friends that that was his lifestyle. But, you know, from his conservative, extremely conservative point of view, libertarian really point of view, it was almost untenable for him to be seen as a conservative activist with, you know, hanging out with people like Jerry Falwell and Paul Weyrich, who was one of the founders of the Heritage Foundation, and also be a homosexual. And so it was a very, very, I'm sure it was a very conflicting thing for the guy. And he died tragically at a very young age.
This is Bob Custer at Reader's Corner. I'm interviewing Mark Johnson today. His book, Tuesday Night Massacre, 4 Senate Elections and the Radicalization of the Republican Party. Well, let's jump right into the first, if we have time to cover all four, we'll see. But the most important one, since this program emanates from the great state of Idaho, let's begin with the campaign and the election, or a defeat, I should say, of Frank Church. For starters, Mark, you know, I didn't get to Idaho until way late in the game. And I must say, after reading your book, I think I've had a very simplistic notion of Idaho in the old days. I would always tell people when I tried to explain Idaho's politics back then that, oh, well, back in the day, the unions were strong and the Democrats were strong because the unions were strong. And therefore, it was a two-party state and liberals like Church could get elected. And reading your book, I'm thinking, you know, it was even tough for liberals like Church to get elected, and it was unusual, and there was still this strong conservative bias in this state. Maybe you can verify what I've just said or correct me on it. I'm good with either one. And then explain who Church was in terms of what he was running against in 1980.
Well, I think you're right, Bob. There's always been a very conservative streak that runs right through the middle of Idaho politics. And a guy like Frank Church had to really carefully navigate that fault line, if you will. And he did it in a variety of ways, I think. Number one, he was a pretty good retail politician. You remember Bethine, his gregarious wife, who was right. Even better as a retail politician, I think.
That's right.
She could wade into any crowd and make friends. He had a terrific staff operation, recruited really capable people to help him on the ground in Idaho, had a legendary chief of staff, Verda Barnes, for many years, who grew up in the shadow of the Capitol in Washington, D.C., was a friend of Eleanor Roosevelt's, very active in the trade union movement during the New Deal period. She was his chief of staff, and she was, by all accounts, an absolutely brilliant political strategist. He also did great constituent service, something, frankly, that I think has really kind of almost disappeared in many ways from the job description of a member of Congress. You know, he answered the mail. He took care of people's inquiries about Social Security problems or whatever it might be. He attended to local issues like, I remember in this period, there was quite a controversy about making improvements in the American Falls Dam in eastern Idaho. Well, Frank Church was all over those kinds of issues. So he was really good at the retail politics. He stayed in touch with Idaho, had a very effective campaign organization that was built around him and his, and frankly, the attractiveness of the guy as an individual. So quite a phenomenon, you know, elected in 1956 at age 32. By the time he runs into the Nick Pack buzzsaw and Steve Sims in 1980, he's been in the Senate for 24 years, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, floor sponsor of the Wilderness Act in 1964, early opponent of the war in Vietnam, and quite famously still, and I argue in the book, conducted the most important investigation maybe in the history of the country into the Central Intelligence Agency and the other intelligence agencies in the 70s, late middle 70s. So this is a very, very accomplished guy, a real intellect, somebody deeply studied in American politics and history, you know, but always walking that fine line, as you suggest, between the conservative impulses in Idaho and him being a player on the international stage, frankly.
And he cast a at least a couple of votes. I mean, he cast a lot of votes, but there were at least a couple that were really major issues in this 1980 race. I wonder if you could address that. And then a second part of my question is, did Frank Church and the church staff see this coming? I mean, these NCPAC guys start early with their commercials, but did they fully understand? It's easy for us to understand it in 2021, but when you're down there on the ground just trying to run a reelection campaign, I suspect it may be a little tougher to see what's coming at you.
Well, that's exactly right. Let me see if I can answer the first part of your question first about the votes that played so heavily in the 1980 election. One was the Panama Canal treaties. Every president since Dwight Eisenhower had worked on a strategy to return sovereignty of the Panama Canal to the Panamanian government. And it finally came to fruition during the Carter presidency in the 1970s. And Frank Church winds up being the floor sponsor of the effort to get the treaties ratified by the United States Senate. There were two separate treaties. And at great political peril to himself, because the Republican right had already seized on the Panama Canal issue as a divisive issue that could be highly weaponized, if you will, made very emotional. And knowing that it might very well cost him his career, he championed that effort in the Senate, succeeded in getting a strong bipartisan endorsement of the treaties. Howard Baker from Tennessee, the Republican senator who later became majority leader, was also one of the, in my judgment, one of the heroes of that issue for standing up for doing the right thing from a foreign policy standpoint. But Richard Viguerie, after the guy that I mentioned earlier, who is the direct mail guru, he realized that that issue was so powerful with sort of this grievance-driven new right population in the country that it could really be weaponized against these guys. And it was very successfully weaponized against Church. So the issue became, he gave away the Panama Canal. In fact, NCPAC and its local affiliate, the Anybody But Church Committee in Idaho, ran a very short television commercial late in the campaign where a guy on camera looks straight into the camera and says, it was our canal and he gave it away. That's what this election's all about. So taking an emotional, a very complicated issue and reducing it down to a soundbite, a bumper sticker. The irony, of course, is that the Panama Canal has operated very successfully under Panamanian control. We don't have the tens of thousands of U.S. military personnel in Panama that we had before. And it's been a success story, just as Church predicted it would be. Second part of your question about did they see this coming? I'd say yes and no. I mean, Terry Dolan was not very circumspect about telegraphing his intentions. They published, you know, their hit list of people that they were going after well in advance of the 1980 election. So it's hard to argue that they weren't aware. The difficulty was, how do you respond? The normal way to you respond, as you know, Bob, in politics, is you don't let any charge go unanswered, because a charge left unanswered is sometimes seen as being a charge that there is no answer for. But how do you answer when the allegation is that you gave away the Panama Canal? Well, it takes a nuanced response to that. You can't get it to fit on a bumper sticker. So the way you respond and how ferociously you respond has the sort of perverted effect of accelerating the charge that's been made. So you repeat the charge that's been made as you try to refute it. So it was a very, very difficult thing. And of these four campaigns that I focus on, each one of them tried it in a variety of different ways to counter these allegations that were coming at them. But it's really difficult when, and I think we see this all the time in politics now, when somebody's character is attacked. And that's what was really happening here. They're really questioning Frank Church's patriotism. They're questioning his commitment to the country. And how do you respond to that when it's so unfair and so outsized in terms of its explosive power? Very, very difficult to respond to that kind of an allegation.
You're listening to Mark Johnson. He's the author of Tuesday Night Massacre, Four Senate Elections and the Radicalization of the Republican Party. Let's move over to the Birch by Dan Quayle race. And again, we don't have a lot of time to go into great detail, but I think it was in this race that you point out that there was a fundamental shift in the way funds were raised for campaigns. Most in the old days, it was state by state, and the people who gave were people who were from the state where the candidates were running. But that seems to have changed. I guess Richard Viguerie probably had a lot to do with that, as you say, the funding father.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Viguerie's started building up his direct mail empire with the Barry Goldwater campaign in 1964. And he literally went to the Secretary of the Senate's office and copied by hand names of people who had contributed to Goldwater's campaign and started to build his lists that way. And he cultivated those lists for years and years and years, constantly adding to them, expanding the universe of people that he was able to direct a message to and at the same time use as a fundraising vehicle. So really, for the first time, I argue, in 1980, you're seeing each of these Senate campaigns become nationalized, so that a housewife in Missouri or a business guy in Texas suddenly has a financial interest, an emotional interest in the election of a United States senator in Idaho. Probably doesn't know either one of the candidates, doesn't know anything about the local issues, but knows that somebody is saying this guy is a problem for the country. And if you believe in our conservative values, you've got to send us a check and we'll get after this guy. So I will update that for just briefly to these recent, really unusual Senate runoff elections in Georgia in early January. So you had two Senate runoff elections, $430 million in outside money spent in those two campaigns during the period from the November election to the January runoff. An astounding amount of money, and raised from all over the country, from small donors and large, who poured money into these so-called independent expenditure campaigns that were basically about attacking one side or the other. So that's what I say by nationalizing these elections. So the fact that Frank Church could care about the American Falls Dam, or Birch Bayh could be a big champion of what he called gasohol for Indiana farmers, suddenly becomes an insignificant issue when the national focus is on who's going to control the United States Senate. The local issues are left sort of on the sidelines. And that really started to happen and has only accelerated since 1980.
As I alluded to earlier, in all four of these cases, you're dealing with highly principled men who are really unwilling to step down from their positions of integrity, you might say, and cutting a few corners, doing a few more negative commercials, attacking rather than simply defending what they've done. Bayh certainly falls into that category, but I want to jump over to Iowa and Culver as perhaps, and we still have McGovern. I don't know whether we're going to get there in this half hour, but that's why people are going to buy your book and read it. But maybe you can tell us about Culver. I found him to be a fascinating man and a great U.S. senator for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, you know, Bob, you and I have been around politics a long time, worked in and around the edges of politics. And, you know, there's no perfect politician. Everyone has feet of clay. There are blemishes in everyone's record. But I came away from my research on these four guys, Church, Bayh, Culver, and McGovern, with an even deeper appreciation of the quality of their character, frankly. And Culver, as you suggest, was a really, really interesting guy. Harvard grad, became very well acquainted with Ted Kennedy when they were students at Harvard, went on to practice law in Iowa, got elected to the House of Representatives and eventually to the Senate in 1974. Deeply, deeply principled guy. The staff loved him. You know, he was bullheaded, no question about it. Somebody said he played politics the way he played football. You know, he was a fullback and right. A big brawny guy and, you know, shirt tail untucked half the time and sweat pouring off his forehead, but a really, really principled guy. The thing that struck me about him and McGovern in particular were that they saw that these campaigns were going to change the nature of the United States Senate, that when every contest in the country become a grudge match over who's going to control the Senate, it's pretty difficult for people to put down their political weapons, so to speak, and find a way to come to compromise or find middle ground on issues when the campaigns are so vicious and the stakes are made to be so high in every single race. So Culver really saw what was going to happen. And he said, and I quote him in the book as saying, it's going to make it difficult for people to be courageous. And it has.
And he actually took on Nick Peck, didn't he? I mean, he spoke out publicly against what Nick Peck was trying to do, especially to him.
Yeah, they all did. And I would say he was among the more eloquent ones in describing mm-hmm. how it was going to change the nature of politics. It was going to, you know, create this radical division between the parties, that it would be, damaging to the institution of the Senate, where, you know, all of these guys, I kind of describe them as the traditionalists versus the radicals who were coming after them. The traditionalists were very much of a mind that the Senate is this kind of special place where you have to have a certain level of collegiality because the rules require you to work together to get very much done. And they saw that that was going to change as a result of these kinds of campaigns.
Yeah. Well, you know, Culver did do one thing, or maybe I should say he didn't do one thing that is unheard of today. And even back when I ran for the Senate in 96, every morning from 10 to noon, they put earphones on me with a microphone and they plugged in telephone calls so I could ask for the maximum federal contribution. Meanwhile, as you point out with your Culver analysis, he never made a phone call to raise money. Isn't that right?
That's right. I talked to one of his top aides, a guy named Jim LaRue, very, very nice guy, who's written a really good little book about how Democrats once were competitive in Iowa. And he said, I never knew the guy to make a fundraising call. He absolutely detested that part of politics, that you had to get on the phone and beg people for money.
That really is amazing in today's world anyway. So let's talk about George McGovern for a moment. We had a couple of minutes here. Please explain, this guy was, of course, an unsuccessful president, but went on to lose this race, but it didn't end for George McGovern there.
No, he's a remarkable American figure, I think, of the 20th century, became sort of the face of American liberalism, which didn't play very well in South Dakota, a state that I know pretty well, having gone to college there, grew up in South Dakota. George McGovern, by the way, was the commencement speaker in my high school graduation. So, yeah, he, again, was sort of the epitome of what I would think of as a prairie populist, somebody who was deeply informed and concerned about the plight of American farmers, you know, made it his business to really understand that. That grew into his concern about issues related to hunger. He worked across the aisle with Bob Dole, the Republican from Kansas, to create the food stamp program and other food security efforts during the time that he was in the United States Senate. A legitimate World War II hero, flew combat missions as a bomber pilot out of Italy during World War II, decorated as a result of that, came to be deeply concerned about American foreign policy during the Vietnam era. So again, just a, you know, a really exemplary guy who ironically is attacked for his not being, tough enough on national security and not being sensitive enough to issues related to the American family. Here's McGovern, you know, family man running against a guy who was a confirmed lifelong bachelor who is being accused of being anti-family. So that was kind of the nature of the attacks that were launched against these guys in 1980.
I have time for one more question, Mark. And what I'd like to do is have you comment on something that I think any reader is going to take away from your book. And that's the difference between running an election to create a movement or running an election to create a governing machine that can get things done in Washington. And I think whether it's the candidates themselves who ran against these four incumbents or whether it's the strategists, you tell us, what were they really doing?
Well, I think maybe that one way to illustrate that would be to just compare the records of the four incumbents who were defeated in 1980 against the people who replaced them. And again, I go back to the traditionalist versus the radical. The traditionalists were all about passing legislation, trying to address problems, working on all kinds of things from wilderness to food security to energy independence. The guys who replaced them basically went to the Senate to say no, to be opposed to things, to try to gum up the works. They were anti-government for the most part. They thought government was the enemy, not the solution to problems. So that's, I think, the difference between running, as you say, to get a job because you want to accomplish things and want to address problems, and running to create a movement. And certainly Terry Dolan, Richard Viguerie, and these guys set out to create a movement to take over the Republican Party and to make it, frankly, an ideological party of limited government that was based, frankly, in many, many respects, I think, on white supremacy, on a sense that there was a segment of the population that could be heavily motivated by grievance, by fear, by anxiety about the future of the country and the world. And that's kind of where we are.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. We didn't get through this book, that's for sure. And I think your treatment of the legacies of the winners and the losers in the second half of the book is really fascinating in light of what's going on today. So I'm going to, again, remind our listeners, get a copy of this book and take a good look at the connections it draws to what we're going through today. The name of the book, Tuesday Night Massacre, Four Senate Elections and the Radicalization of the Republican Party, by Mark Johnson. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner, Mark.
Bob, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the issues and ideas that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.